Hi, this is John Shackleton. Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast.
Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Today, I'm absolutely excited to be having a conversation with John Shackleton. John has a background in elite sports as an athlete himself, but equally as a sports psychologist. So he knows a thing or two about peak performance. He's coached some of the leading athletes in the world, and he's been able to see what really works and what really doesn't. And over the years, what I really discovered in this conversation is that John's definition of peak performance has changed. As he went through his own life challenges and experiences, he came across the practice of mindfulness. And mindfulness is something that has radically changed the way he approaches life, radically changed the way he approaches business, and has had not just really good dividends in terms of his own mental and emotional well-being, but really great commercial outcomes as well. John's blog at johnshack.com is really well worth a read. I'd commend it to you. There's lots of tidbits and snippets of great information there. But without any further ado, to discuss mindfulness, business, peak performance, and everything in between, here's John Shackleton. John Shackleton, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Thanks for taking the time out of your day all the way in New Zealand to come and talk to us. How's things across the ditch?
Well, not the brightest of days today, but I think I wish I had a bit more of your sun.
Well, we have a glorious day today, so I'll send some across for you, mate. We're looking forward to...
Yeah, that'll be good. That'll be really nice. Yeah. I can send you some rain in return. How would that be?
I'm happy for you to keep that, to be honest. I'm really pleased to have you on our show because we had a little conversation off air and I've been following your stuff now for a while, and you've got a really fascinating and interesting background. You've been involved in sports psychology, elite performance, and of course, more recently, you're now really known for helping people understand mindfulness and to have, I suppose, a different understanding of success and create a life that's rich and meaningful. I'm just wondering if you could help us understand your journey by just giving us a bit of a cook's journey of how you got to this point in your life.
Sure. Well, as a youth, I was heavily involved in sport up to close to international standard, never quite made international standard, then became an international coach, actually, was a professional coach for many years. My sport was swimming, and studied sports psych because I finally realized a couple of years of coaching that the brain was the thing that was making people win or lose, not the muscles. And sports psych, there was no money in sports psych back in those days. I'm an old bastard. I'm in my 60s now. But
you're in your prime, mate.
But in those days... Sorry?
You're in your prime.
Yeah, I feel like it. In those days, there was no such thing as sports psych in the UK. In fact, if you thought positively over there, you're a bit of a nutcase. So all of the stuff I had to learn through books, and I started applying that and worked with various international teams and stuff. And one day, one of the guys from the British triathlon team said to me, would you come and talk to my salespeople about that? Because he ran a sales company. And I looked down my nose a bit at him and said, well, why would I do that? And he said, oh, we'll pay you. And I thought, that sounds good, because nobody's paying me to do sports psych. Because there was very little money in sport back in those days. So ever since, I suppose I was about 25, what I've done is I've trained and coached people in business with regards to performance. So I got into that a long time ago, ran a big company back in the UK doing that, and eventually sort of got sick of life a little bit and decided to emigrate to calmer parts of the world. So I came to New Zealand and still doing the same thing. But then, unfortunately, the wheels all fell off for me. About 5 years ago, I've been very successful, a top performer in just about everything I've ever done. And I know, Jesse, you're the same sort of person as that. And one day, realized that I couldn't keep functioning this way, that my mind wasn't working properly, that I was unhappy with my life, generally. Despite making a chunk of money and traveling the world, speaking to companies, and I wasn't really happy. In fact, I was worse than happy. I was depressed. I was actually had clinical depression. Didn't really understand how or why, despite coming from a sports psych background. You know, it hits us if we're not careful.
Yeah, so there's a whole lot of things in there that I'd love to just pick a few threads and pull on them and see where we unravel. But with your going back to that background in sports and performance, we had a little conversation off air about, you know, really what does peak performance mean? And we often think in our lives, this is a business program for dentists, and dentists are typically type A people. We're driven to perfection in lots of things. And yeah, I remember at university, it was very binary. It was either perfect or it was wrong. There wasn't much in between. And it was a bit of a hard slog, to be honest with you. And I think, you know, most people listening to this show will have a touch of perfectionism around them. And I'm curious to understand, I imagine that's the same in sporting teams and elite performers.
Absolutely. We're all looking for that. Everybody, I think, is looking for that final edge, that little bit of, you know, I'm better. I can get better. I can create more. So if you look at the internal causes of stress, there are 8 in total, I believe, and 5 of them are absolutely typical of an A personality. And I'll give you, it was quite a shock. I'll give you these 5. Perfectionism, which you've already mentioned, controlling approach, where most of us are control freaks, an all or nothing attitude. Well, I've been developing and teaching that for 35 years. Highly competitive. Most people in A personalities are incredibly competitive. And goal obsessive. Those are the 5 top causes of internal causes of stress in people. And yet, funnily enough, those are 5 of the 6 or 7 categories that the corporate world is recruiting on. And any entrepreneur will say that's exactly what's made them successful. And yet they're the causes of internal stress.
So that's really fascinating, because I'm just doing a bit of a mental checklist on all of those 5 things. And I've gone, yes, 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 tick,
yeah,
tick, tick.
Absolutely. Right. When I teach this from stage, the audience is just bloody nodding. All of them are nodding and saying, that's me.
Yeah. But the thing around that, John, is how do you achieve performance and balance that? How do you walk that line where you've got enough of that to help you achieve some things that are important to you without tipping over the edge? How do you recognize when you're walking up to the edge and so you don't go over it?
I think a lot of that has to do with what you consider success is. What you think peak performance is. And I think we do get distorted. We were talking beforehand about, you know, various sports like gymnastics and swimming, exactly the same. We strive for that tiny, tiny, tiny increment of success. In swimming, it can come down to a couple of hundredths of seconds. And we might be number 3 in the world, but as far as our brain's concerned, we're number 10, you know, 10,000, because we haven't got that world record yet, or we haven't qualified for those Olympics yet. The crazy thing about it is, in our mind, we're 10,000 on the list. The truth of the matter is, we're still number 7, and yet we do not stand back and look at it and understand what success really is. I think for a lot of people, we chase our goals are ridiculously refined to the point where failure is quite disastrous for us. We set ourselves up for failure. We really do.
That's a really interesting thing. How is it that we set ourselves up for failure? Because what I notice is resilience is a word that gets a lot of press these days, and we talk about being able to cope with adversity and setbacks. But if we're setting ourselves up for failure in the first place, then if we could avoid that, surely that's half the battle.
It is. I think a lot of it is a misunderstanding about this concept of control. I talk about this a lot with people. You know, people say, well, you know, I need to be in control. I need to feel in control. And great teams talk about, let's control the things we can control. Well, let me ask you, Jesse, a few questions. You don't have to answer these, but your audience will. What do you control? Do you control the weather, for example?
Absolutely.
The answer is no, right?
No.
Do you control the traffic? No. And yet, we allow those things to stress us. Do we control other people? No, not at all. And then people will eventually, if I keep questioning and saying, what do you control? They'll say, I control myself. And my statement back is, no, you don't. I know you want to, but you eat the donut despite the fact that you know you shouldn't eat the donut. And you don't go to the gym despite the fact that you know you should. we don't actually control anything in life at all, nothing. We do our best to try and control things, but actually we don't. So an athlete who's got the Commonwealth Games and has pictured the fact that they are going to win and their gold medal, the only thing they control is themselves. That's the person in their lane. They control nothing else. And yet their success and failure is built on the fact that they have to be number one. Well, you can't control that. I know there's an element of controlling you. You can do the best you can do. If you happen not to catch a cold or if you happen not to get injured, the amount of control that we have is very little. But we obsess about it so much. Success has become so important in our minds through our own processes, our own thinking processes, that we feel we have to be in control. But we're not. Truth of the matter is we're not. I mean, when you cut yourself, Jesse, if you cut your hand, right, and you get a little cut on your hand, what do you do to fix that? You don't do anything.
Not really.
The universe fixes it. Yeah. Well, you don't.
No.
You don't fix it, do you? And when you plant an acorn, what do you do to make the oak tree grow? Absolutely nothing. Something out there fixes it. And it ain't us. We're not in control. I think what happened for me was when I learned that I wasn't driving the bus, when I really understood that I wasn't driving the bus, and I was able to let go of control, or this obsession with control, which actually doesn't really exist. When I was able to do that, things dramatically changed for me. My stress levels halved just by that concept. But all my life, I've been teaching people about having more control over the things you can control, which is a false, well, it's a silly thing to get involved in, to be honest.
Yeah, look, it's an interesting thing. One of my good friends and mentors often says to me, "Yeah, Jesse, your business growth is inversely proportioned to your need for control."
Absolutely.
And it's a really interesting thing because for most of us who are type A personalities, we kind of have this view that no one can do it as well as we can. Delegation is almost not quite a dirty word. We understand the concept and we want to be able to do it, but we struggle really hard to delegate. And it's holding on, holding on, holding on. And there's this natural tendency to hold on. And intellectually, we understand that we need to give up certain degrees of control. But emotionally, doing that is a very different experience to understanding the intellectual premise. So how do you...
It's actually 100% accepting that. It's not understanding it. I think we all understand it. It's actually completely buying into that and saying, well, what I'm actually doing is releasing... Can I release my success off to the universe to let it sort itself out? It's almost a spiritual question, isn't it? I don't mean religious. I'm not saying it's not God. I'm just saying that it's not me. I am not driving the bus. If I actually accept that and do the best I can, that's a huge step for most of us. Most of us, it's a pretty very difficult step to take.
And I think therein lies a little comment or phrase there as well, John, that you've just mentioned in passing, but I think it's an important phrase to pick up on, and that is, if I do the best I can, because equally, you can't expect to achieve things in life by essentially outsourcing everything to the universe and not doing anything to prepare yourself either, correct? I mean, you couldn't say, I'm going to go to the Commonwealth Games, I'm 45 years old, well, I'm actually 46 years old, but I'm 46 years old, I've never swum competitively in my life, but I'm just going to put my faith in the universe. That's equally not what you're saying. So,
no, I don't think that's going to work.
There's two really good reasons why that won't work. Is one is clearly I have no swimming talent, and secondly, no one needs to see me in a pair of Speedos, mate. Let me tell you that.
Well, it's funny, but I think a lot of this hit home to me as a swimmer. I've been a swimmer all my life, right? And I made an attempt a few years ago, about 5 years ago, I made an attempt on Cook Strait, which is... It's only 26 kilometers, and it's only 15 degrees, and it's only shark-infested, and it's only one of the most... And you can't wear a wetsuit, by the way. And it's only one of the most dangerous pieces of water in the world. What could possibly go wrong? But the point is, when you become really focused on that, you think you're in control. You think you're in control. But, you know, I turn up on the day, and it's a lovely, calm day, but the water's 15 or 14 degrees. How long will your body last in that? Well, I suppose you could say that depends on how much training you've done in that temperature of water. I suppose you could say I have some element of control, but, you know, what if a storm comes up? How much control have I got of that? What if a shark, and the place is shark infested, what if a shark turns up? How much control do we have? We don't. Now, I didn't get across. I got 6 hours in and got pulled out with hypothermia. And it's very easy to blame ourselves and say, well, I didn't do enough of this or I didn't do enough of that. But had I just happened to do it 3 weeks earlier, I'd have walked on the top of the water because it was nice and warm and I'd have got out, you know. So we are not at our own, we are not in control. There's an awful lot around us that we don't control. And it's our obsession with control that screws us up.
Okay. So let's talk about...
Weird, isn't it?
It is weird. But let's talk about some perspectives, because one of the things that we spoke about just before we got started was sports people. And they're training hard, they're working hard. And same in business, you know, they're working hard, they're training hard. Interestingly, one of my observations around business is, compared to sports, it's a small little side note, tangent, is that sports people train awfully hard and they compete rather infrequently. And the opposite seems to be the way of the world in business, in the sense that you're competing every day, but not enough time spent training. But that's a whole nother...
Yeah, none whatsoever, usually in business.
Exactly. It just seems completely back to front. But anyway, that's a whole conversation. But what I wanted to talk about was the concept of an elite sports person. I mentioned to you that I've got a daughter who's a competitive gymnast. She trains exceptionally hard, and you've worked with elite sports people as well. And of course, as a parent, you want to make sure that your kids are enjoying what they're doing, they're having fun, but they don't get so tied up in it that it becomes their identity. And I think that sometimes when failure occurs or something's taken away from you, it can feel like your sense of identity is taken away as well. So I wondered if you'd come across that in your work much.
Yes, a lot, actually. And in fact, just to reiterate what you and I spoke about off air, a sports psych's job these days, unfortunately, is helping people with those problems. It's not actually about helping people achieve more. It's actually mopping up the mess that has occurred because they become so intense. So it's a great shame. It didn't used to be the case, but it is now. Yeah, there's a whole area. I've been working with one of New Zealand's top swimmers, and that individual is not only physically unbelievably talented, one of the best in the world, but also mentally could get into Oxford or Cambridge University anytime they wanted to. So you'd think they have everything, right? And yet they wake up in the morning with huge anxiety, massive anxiety, scared about their future. Now, we look at that individual and go, goodness me, they have the most unbelievable future. But that's not happening inside their head. Their head is one of anxiety. And a lot of it has to do with this identity thing. I am Fred the swimmer. Or what happens when I don't succeed? I'm not Fred the swimmer anymore. Who am I? What's left? And it's a crazy situation. Or I am Fred the academic, or I am Fred the businessman. What happens if I fail? I don't exist anymore. I'm not there. Who the hell am I? And I think it's all of that mixed together with my own challenges that led me to mindfulness as a concept, because mindfulness actually teaches you that you aren't your thinking. We believe our mind, we believe what's going on in our mind, and yet actually it talks a whole load of junk. It's just a tool that we've been given that helps us fix problems. It's not us. And a mindfulness teaches you to stand back and understand that this thing we've got on our shoulders is a computer that's got a glitch. Most of us have got a glitch and it ain't working properly. But we take it as though it's us. We take it as though it's real. We take the comments our mind makes literally. So when it tells us we're a jerk, we believe it. And yet all it is a computer that's got a glitch. Why can't we just let it go? It's not us. It's not who we are. And there's the challenge, I think, for just about everybody on the planet, is that their mind has got a glitch and they need to reboot it.
So there's a couple of things in there, John, that, I'd really love to pick on, because what I'm hearing you say is that your views on what peak performance actually is seems to have evolved over a period of time. Once upon a time, it might have been the traditional achieve more, do more, have more kind of routine. But now peak performance and, dare I say, definitions of success have changed. You know, one of the things we speak about in our group is external success and internal success. And I shared with you my story that my first dental practice, if anyone had looked at it, you know, would have been wildly successful to the outsider. But internally, I was miserable, unhappy, and unfulfilled. And every part of my life, as a result of that, began to suck quite a bit, if you'll pardon the turn of phrase. But I'm curious to understand how your view of peak performance has changed. And then I want to explore mindfulness, because I do know that there's people listening here saying, I'm not quite ready to give up on my goals. I know that I'm not quite... It's going to challenge some people as they're listening to us speak, and they're going...
I don't think we need to give up on our goals. I think what we need to do is to realize that achievement of our goals isn't everything. And as a professional athlete, it becomes everything in your life. It becomes... There is nothing else. And that lays us back into our definition of identity again, doesn't it? About where identity comes from. I think... It's really worth understanding. I'm not suggesting we should give up on our goals. I have become less, much, much less goal focused, but I still have goals. I still chase things. I've just realized that those things aren't actually the fundamental part of where I'm going in this world. I'm not here to have a bigger boat or a bigger car or a bigger house or more money in the bank. And because now if I look at some of the richest people in the world, how come those people are still working their pants off? How come they're still stressed? How come they still don't have time for their family? How come they have physical and mental ailments that are bugging them? If they've got all the money in the world, surely that would be success. But we become completely obsessed with that, and yet actually that cannot be success, because look at the successful people. Are they happy? Because we think the money's going to make us happy. It's not true. Far from true. It's actually happiness that we're all chasing. We think certain things will make us happy, but technically they don't. What I've found with most A personalities is that when we're goal-obsessed, what happens is that we achieve our goal and life is great for a few days or maybe a week. And then we become obsessed with the next goal. So we work for a year for 1 week of happiness, which is bloody crazy.
It's nuts, isn't it?
And we've got to get out of that habit. We've got to move ourselves away from that habit. And I'm not suggesting we shouldn't get the goals, but the point is to work for 1 year and to be happy for a week is suicide.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing because, again, we're talking off air a little bit about chasing the goal and relentless pursuit of things. And, you know, whether it's a sporting goal or a business goal or whatever, it's about, in my mind, keeping some perspective. And, again, this all ties back to the identity thing, of course, as well, in the sense that sport might be part of someone's life, business might be part of someone's life, but it's not their life. It's not the sum total of who they are. And I was sharing with you that my daughter, the gymnast, if ever I think I'm having a tough day, I just think of her with Chinese and Russian coaches kind of training her really, really hard.
German ones even worse.
Yeah, exactly. Like really hard. And these kids work really, really hard. But again, it's about this pursuit of excellence is partly fine, but it's when it becomes all-consuming that what I'm hearing you say is the problem. And so what I wanted to ask you off the back of that really is... mindfulness and mindfulness practice, where does that fit into business life in a practical sense? We most people would be familiar with the word mindfulness. It's certainly got a lot of currency at the moment. And again, we spoke about off air being, you know, peace and time being a currency compared to money. Where does mindfulness fit into that equation?
Yeah, I got into mindfulness really just to get rid of my stress. Because that, to me, was really important, is understanding that I had to reduce my stress levels. What I found in mindfulness, I think, was much more of an understanding of, A, who I am, what I'm here for, and what is important to me. Those things have always been there. I just didn't discover them until I became mindful. And I must say that the idea of, oh, yeah, I think I'll be more mindful is a bit like saying, oh, yeah, I think I'll go on a diet, because nothing bloody happens. People say these things. They have no real concept of it. I was obsessed with mindfulness because I had to reduce my stress to get rid of my depression. There is no other option, to be honest with you. You can look at everything you want other than the drug option, which I didn't want to go down. The only option when you study it is to become mindful. So I had no choice but to pursue that approach. And when I pursued that approach, it changed everything. It completely changed my view of the world and what's important and how my business ought to run. And despite the fact that I didn't want to do any of that, it became so painfully obvious to me that actually this is what I need to be doing and this is how I need to chase it. And funnily enough, if you measure success, my success in life hasn't changed at all. I'm still earning the same sort of money as I was before. I just don't have any stress around it anymore. I don't have this obsession with doing more, creating more, being in control. All that's happened is that I've completely changed my perspective, and life is a lot easier and more relaxed. And I spend time doing the things I really should be doing, which is spending time with my kids and stuff. And yet what I used to refer to as success, it hasn't changed at all. It's just that I'm not focused on that. I don't think about that anymore. It is important, but it's not what I'm on the planet for. Whereas it used to be, this is where I'm going, this is who I am, I got that completely wrong.
Yeah. So I'm curious to ask then, because again, there'll be people listening to the podcast who will be familiar with mindfulness as a concept and a construct. There'll be others who this might be new for. I'm wondering if you can give us your version of what mindfulness means to you. Most people would understand the concept of being present and so on, but what does it mean in a practical sense?
Practically, basically what we're doing in mindfulness is learning to think about the now, what's happening at this very second. Most of our time, we are thinking about the past and the future. I would say for the average Joe that hasn't studied and practiced mindfulness for 3 or 4 years, 99.9% of their time they're thinking about the past and the future. Very rarely are we in the moment. I'll give you an example of being in the moment. When my first son was born, there was a lot going on with my wife. All the doctors and nurses were there, but I was looking after to Luke, and I was looking down in his eyes, and he opened his eyes, and he looked at me. And now I know he doesn't focus or anything, but it's just one of those wow moments, one of those connection moments. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But if you think about it, that was a now moment. How long did that last? Probably a second or two. And then I started thinking, how am I going to pay for this? Or you know what I mean? So I've immediately straight back into the future. I'm not thinking about what's happening now. And it's incredibly rare that our mind is spent in the moment, actually loving what we do. If you think about it, when you eat a meal, very rarely are you actually thinking about the actual food and the taste and the texture and the color and the flavor of the food. Most of the time you're either having a conversation or watching the TV or on your phone. We're not in the moment. And I think one of the challenges is that modern society is pushing us further and further away from the moment. Because, you know, we're constantly on the phone planning what we're going to do next or worried about what happened yesterday. And actually, one of the strongest arguments for me in all of this is when I realized that all negative emotions, in order to experience a negative emotion, you have to think about the past or the future. So, for example, guilt. If you want to experience guilt, then you're going to have to go and think about the past to find out what it is you need to be guilty about. If you want to experience fear or anxiety, you're going to have to think about the future, because that's what fear and anxiety is about. It's not about the current moment. It's about what might happen in the future. So in order to not experience those things, all you have to do is think about now. And that's amazingly profound if you think about it. If you want to eliminate fear, just don't think about the future. Now, obviously, to be practical in the world, we have to do a bit of planning every now and then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But what we do is we spend 99.9% of our life away from our life. Our life is now. You don't have anything else. The past is gone and the future you can't guarantee. So the only thing we've actually got is now, and yet we spend all of our time thinking about other things.
So I'm curious, John. because it's about being in the now. And you mentioned to me about connection, that the moment you had with Luke when he was born. And one of our core values in our practice is connection. And connection really does require presence. It does require you to be in that moment, right?
Absolutely.
And so what, yeah, and that's something that we consciously try to do and incorporate some mindfulness practice into our dental practice to varying degrees of success. We're far from perfect. But what I've observed, and I'm interested in your perspective on this, is creating meaningful relationships requires presence. It requires...
total presence, yes.
Yeah. And so if we are, as dentists, in a relationship business, which we are, mindfulness actually is, I think, a critical part of not just having great interactions with our patients, but our team and other relationships as well. So do you see that there's a commercial link there as well? I'm just trying to see.
Oh, massive.
Yeah.
Massive link. In fact, I deal with salespeople all the time. That's a lot of the people I actually present to, speak to. And if you think about it, most of us, and this is particularly bad for salespeople, when we're in a conversation, we're not present. What we're doing is we're thinking about what we're going to say next. We're thinking about what are the repercussions of this conversation, or what did I say to that last guy to get over this objection, or we're not present. 99% of the time, we're not. But if we're present, if we're really listening, really focused on the individual, then a relationship happens. Then you become sort of connected to this person. When you're really present and you really work hard at just listening to what they're saying and not having any thought around that, any judgment, any view of what they're saying, then you really become present with them and you develop a relationship. It's impossible not to. That person becomes closer to you and you become closer to them, which is everything in business, isn't it?
Completely. Yeah.
This is so commercially important, it's not true.
So it's really funny, I talk in dentistry because, again, just a little bit of context, dentistry has become a competitive market. Years ago, it was not so competitive, but now it's very commercially competitive. And one of the things that I'm often teaching, I run a coaching community, that one of the things we talk about with our Practice Max guys is about getting the most out of what you've got. So there's this constant desire, and our inboxes are hit regularly with, the latest SEO thing or, whatever it happens to be, get more patients. It's what we spoke about earlier. It's more, right? And my philosophy, that's fine, and I get that that's part of the plan and, whatever, but again, it's not the totality of it all. And my view is that part of business really is maximizing what we've already got. And what I mean by that is if we can truly connect with our team, if we can truly connect with our patients, then we're going to create loyalty and relationships. And if you've got patients that come back and see you time and again, then that minimizes the need to be marketing. If you've got staff that stay with you for years on end, you don't lose the productivity that that invariably happens when you have staff turnover. So again, I see that mindfulness and being a mindful leader of your business, being a mindful manager, is a critical part of running a commercially successful enterprise.
I totally agree with you. And yet it's really difficult to see that when our head is in this process of becoming more successful and becoming more competitive. And when our head is there, when we're thinking in those terms, we're not being mindful, obviously, but we're not trying to develop a relationship. Because you can't dabble at relationships.
No.
Well, I did when I was a teenager. You can't, but you can't really dabble at them. You're either in or you're not. In every relationship, you can't have half a T-shirt. You're either in this relationship or you're not. And most of us are vaguely in the relationship. We're dangling our toe in the water. We're not. I'm talking about client relationship. When we're really friends with somebody, when we're really connected with them, when you're being mindful in their presence, it just makes this huge connection. It's not a slight step up. It's a massive connection. Something I want to pick you up on here, this is really interesting. You used the phrase, dentistry has become very competitive, and I completely understand every business is these days. But here's the point. Dentistry is actually a service, isn't it? You're helping people.
Yeah.
It's what do you mean it's competitive? Because it's actually, how can you compete when you're helping somebody? It's actually, it's a service. It's not competitive at all. But I understand from a business perspective, it's become hugely competitive.
Yes, you're right. And I guess the thing that my take on all of this really is that if we can focus on relationships, I wrote a book called Retention, which was all around retaining patients because it ties in with what we're talking about. And I gave the book, the manuscript, to a friend of mine to read as a proof. And he said, oh, I've got the working title for you. And I said, oh, okay, what's that? And again, just excuse my language. He says, don't be a dickhead and be engaged. And that was his take on the title.
It's completely true, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is. And so I guess in all of that, it's about understanding the importance of relationships. Relationships, in my mind, make the world go round. And one...
Well, there is nothing else, is there? I mean, that's all there is, actually. That's all we have.
It is.
It's our communication with other people. We have nothing else. And yet, what we do is we let our mind wander onto other stuff and take us away from the only thing that's important, which is a connection with the person we're in front of, or on the phone to, like yourself. I've noticed something since I've changed across, and I don't do the peak performance stuff anymore. I only do the mindfulness stuff. Is that my clients are no longer my clients; they're my friends. I get phone calls from them saying, oh, let's go and get a coffee. I haven't chewed the fat with you for ages. I never used to get that, but they've become friends now. And that's because when I'm in a mindful place, which is not all the time, far from it, I'm really connecting with them. They are my mate. I had a phone call this morning from a guy I did a roadshow for earlier this year. And you know, I've known him for years, but we did this roadshow, and I was sat in his car while he was driving, being really attentive to him and paying a lot of attention, and he's become a good friend. And yet I've known him for years. And I didn't do it intentionally. I did it because I understand mindfulness. I didn't do it to make more money out of this guy. I did it because I understand mindfulness. And he's a friend, and we chat. And I'm sure he'll book me to speak to his teams again.
Yeah. And that's great, but that's the natural consequence. It's not the motivation.
It's a consequence of, that's absolutely right. And I think we become obsessed with what's the outcome? Where am I going? What can I achieve? And therefore, we're not mindful.
Yeah. So I wanted just to pick up on a slightly different train of thought, but I think there's going to be an interrelated thread, and that is the concept of being values-driven and where that might fit in with mindfulness. Because, again, from the point of view of feeling happy and content with life, yes, there's mindfulness, yes, there's relationships, and golly, we completely get on board with the importance of that. But in terms of feeling congruent and feeling like I'm being true to myself and creating a business that reflects those values and beliefs, how do you see that tying in with mindfulness? Do you see that there's an interplay there, or do you think that they're just two separate things?
No, I think they are very strongly linked. And I think when we're mindful, what we do is we come back to our true self. I think this is when I can get myself into a mindful state, I come back to my true self. I become me. I become John. Actually, no, technically I don't become John because I don't know the name of my true self, but you know what I mean.
There's a podcast episode right there, by the way.
Well, John is my ego. John is not really me. It's my mind trying to exert authority or be in charge or be in control or achieve excellence. That's what John is. But the thing inside of me, and we're getting a bit spiritual here, and I don't mean to be doing this, but the thing inside of me where I go when I am being mindful, I don't have to worry about my values because they're so painfully obvious. when you're really true and really internal and really being mindful, there is no way in hell that I would do anything other than what my values are, because I'm being true to me.
So mindfulness is a path to being in tune with your values.
It is. And it's something which you cannot master. That path, you have to practice it constantly, because in my case, I've had 60 years of practicing the opposite. And therefore, in my head, I've got these neural pathways which are the opposite of mindfulness, because I was never even aware of mindfulness. So I have overcome these mental habits of the last 60 years. So I find myself slipping back into those very easily.
Well, it's funny you should say that, John, because I've done a fair bit of mindfulness training over the years. I've done all sorts of silent meditation retreats, you name it. I've ticked a lot of those boxes. And each and every one of those practices and learnings has been really profound, really helpful, and certainly very beneficial. But I have to tell you, I feel a little bit like I get on the bandwagon and then I fall back off, and I've got to consciously develop almost a discipline to be mindful.
Without any doubt, you've hit the nail on the head. You're never going to crack this, unless you become a Buddhist monk and you do 40 years in there. And I wouldn't recommend, don't get me wrong, it'd be a great life, but unless you've refigured the neural pathways inside your mind, you're going to fall back onto the old ways. There's no doubt about that at all. So the meditation approach, which is how you become mindful, is a constant, they talk about it being a practice. That means you never get it right. You're constantly practicing the process. And if you are constantly aware, what I've found in the last 4 or 5 years, and, you know, I've done silent retreats and all that sort of stuff as well, but I found fantastic peace and tranquility at those things, but it disappears. When you come back to the real world, it just goes away. The practice of doing this every single day, constantly thinking of ways how I can put this into practice in my life, that's the only way I'm going to overcome these old neural pathways that drive me back to the John, the thinking John, the person that's planning and goal-obsessed and control freak John. That's so normal and natural to me. I need to work on the other approach, the real me, all the time. But I find that so rewarding, because it actually feels so much more comfortable being the real person that I am. And rather than having to maintain this effort to be John, it's just, when I'm relaxed, I don't have to think about it. I'm just me. And my values shine through without trying.
Yeah, I think that's really lovely.
That's weird, isn't it?
Yes and no. It makes perfect and intuitive sense, yet I also realize it's an uncommon practice for many people. I wanted to, as we start to conclude, wrap up, I guess, our conversation with some practical things for the audience to take away, because there'll be people listening go, yep, got it, I love it, and I don't want to I don't want to reduce it to cookbooks and 3 simple steps to eternal peace, but I do want to give the audience something practical that they could take away. So if we were going to give them a couple of things that they could really hang their hat on and get started on that journey, what would they be?
For me, the turning point was understanding that I've got to remake these neural pathways, and the only way of doing that is to learn a process of meditation. Now, meditation isn't what I thought it was. It's not wearing an orange coat and sitting on the floor and going, Om. That's what I thought it was, but that's not what it is. So I had to basically get as much information about meditation as I possibly could. Just to put those of you that don't understand meditation, don't worry about it. I thought I had to be in a certain place and sit cross-legged on the floor. No, I very often meditate when I'm driving. Now, I do live in Auckland, which means I'm doing about 20 k's an hour, but there are many, many different ways of meditating. Some of them are more effective and stronger than others, but meditation is something you can do anywhere. You can do it for 5 seconds. You can do it while you're having a cup of tea. You can do it while you're talking in a meeting. So it's not what we think it is. But what I would suggest is that developing a series of meditative practices is incredibly powerful at helping you to discover or rediscover a mindful approach to life. I'm absolutely certain young children are amazingly mindful. I don't remember back to my younger days, but if I watch young children, they don't think about the consequences of what they're doing. They just do it.
Yeah, which is fantastic.
That's almost the definition of mindfulness. And so when you relearn this, you rediscover it, it's unbelievably comfortable because it's who you are. This practice is who you are. So you fit into it and feel it and go, I'm home, this is right, this is how life ought to be. And it's discovering ways of doing that 1,000 times a day.
Lovely. Excellent. John, you have been incredibly generous with your time today, and I really thank you for not just your practical advice, but your insights and your experience as someone who's walked down the traditional path around peak performance and seen it for what it is, and been able to help guide other people on a journey that will definitely lead to greater fulfillment, greater enjoyment in life, and more meaning as well. And so I think that journey from the traditional approach to the one where you're now clearly fulfilled, clearly doing your life's work, is a fascinating journey. I thank you for sharing it with us, mate. It's really profound.
And just to finish off, thank you so much for allowing me to and prompting me to say some of these things that I've said. They're not my message. They're a universal message. But it's lovely to have the opportunity to put this message out to people and be able to communicate. And that I'm very fortunate that I do that for a living. So that's lovely. And if any of your audience want a great speaker at their conference, give me a call.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you want to find out more about what John does, head across to johnshack.com. Check out his blog in particular. There's tons and tons and tons of really useful and practical strategies there. I really like the blog. I go there regularly and read snippets here and there, and I would really encourage everyone to do the same. Again, John, thank you so much. Your wisdom, your generosity, and certainly your life experience really shine through, and we thank you so much for sharing it with us today.
Thank you.
Really hope you enjoyed that episode with John Shackleton. So much there in terms of practical information about leading not just a more commercially successful life in terms of business, but a really and truly fulfilled life in terms of happiness and what matters most. And as you can see, John's own journey has led him to redefine what peak performance means. So rather than the relentless pursuit of goals and money and other things like that, while those ambitions and aspirations are still there, he's not attached to them in the way he once was. So lots of really practical and useful things in that conversation. So I hope you have some great notes from the podcast episode there, and I'm looking forward to hearing how you apply them in your own life for greater fulfillment and greater commercial success as well. But until next week, have a great week, and we will see you on the flip side. Take care. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.